Chapter 11. The strain attendant on watching another swing faded. The men were turning away from the map, and there was a murmur of conversation. Somebody said something about using the opportunity to acquire all the possible data on time travel. Counselor Kendlin remarked that the body's accumulation of energy was fairly convincing proof that time travel would never be popular. It was Dressley, the precise, the orderly, who finally remarked, "Gentlemen, we are here as delegates of the Council to listen to Mr. Hedrock's report of the counterattack against the Empress. In his report some weeks ago, he was able to give us administrative details, and you will recall that we found his organization set up to be efficient in the extreme. Mr. Hedrock, will you now bring us up to date?" Hedrock glanced from person to person thoughtfully. He saw that they were watching him, and that raised his necessity level. His problem, it seemed to him, was to make up his own mind about the seesaw, then carry out his decision without regard for the attitude of his nominal superiors. It would be difficult. He began succinctly, "Since the first directive was given me, we have set up 1,242 new shops, primarily in small villages, and 3,809 contacts have been established, however tenuous in some cases, with imperial government personnel, both military and civil." He explained briefly his system of classifying the various individuals into groups on the basis of vocation, degree of importance, and, what was more important, pitch of enthusiasm for the venture into which the Empress had precipitated her adherents. "From three scientists," Hedrock went on, "who regard the weapon shops as an integral part of Isher civilization, we gained in the first 10 days the secret of the science behind the time-energy machine, insofar as that science is known to the government. We discovered that of the four generals in charge of the enterprise, two were opposed to it from the beginning. A third was won over when the building disappeared. But the fourth, General Dukar, the man in charge, unfortunately will not abandon the attack until she does. He is an Empress man in the sense of personal loyalty, transcending his own feelings and opinions." He paused, expecting them to comment. But no one said anything, which was actually the most favorable response of all. Hedrock continued, "Some thousands of officers have deserted the Imperial forces, but only one member of the Imperial Council, Prince Del Curtin, openly opposed the attack after the execution of Banton Vickers, who, as you know, criticized the whole plan. And the prince's method of disapproval has been to withdraw from the palace while the attack is in progress." "Which brings us," said Hedrock, "to the Empress herself." He summarized her character for them. The glorious Inelda, an orphan since her 11th birthday, had been crowned when she was 18 and was now 25. "An age," said Hedrock grimly, "which is an in-between stage in the development of the animal man to human man levels." He saw that they were puzzled by his reiteration of facts they all knew, but he had no intention of condensing his account. He had his own formula for defeating the Empress, and he wanted to state it at least once in as skillful a fashion as possible. "At 25, he said, "Arinelda is emotional, unstable, brilliant, implacable, impatient of restrictions on her desires, and just a bit unwilling to grow up. As the thousands of reports came in, it seemed to me finally that our best method of dealing with such a person was to leave channels along which she could withdraw gracefully when the crises came." He looked around questioningly. He was keenly aware that with these men he dared not try to put his ideas over in a disguised form. He said frankly, "I hope that council members will not take it amiss if I recommend for their consideration the following basic tactic. I am counting on some opportunity occurring of which we can take advantage and so bring her whole war machine to a stop. My assumption is that once it has stopped, the Empress will busy herself with other matters and conveniently forget all about the war she started." Hedrock paused in order to give weight to his next words. "My staff and I will watch anxiously for the opportunity and will call your attention to anything that seems to have possibilities. And now, are there any questions?" The first few were minor. Then a man said, "Have you any notion as to what form this so-called opportunity will take?" Hedrock said carefully, "It would be difficult to go into all the avenues that we are exploring. This young woman is open on many fronts to persuasion and to pressure. She is having a hard time with recruits for the army. She is still subject to the connivances and intrigues of a group of older people who are reluctant to accept her as an adult. They withhold information from her. Despite her efforts to keep in touch with what is going on, she is caught in an old, old net. Her communication with the real world is snarled up. Headrock finished. In one way or another, we are trying to take advantage of these various weaknesses. The man who had already spoken said, "This is only a formula." "It is a formula," said Headrock, "based on my study of the character of the Empress." "Don't you think you had better leave such studies to the P sub P machine expert and to the no men?" I examined all the weapon shop data on the lady before offering my suggestion. "Still," said the man, "it is up to the elected council to make decisions in such matters." Headrock did not back down. "I have made a suggestion," he said, "not a decision." The man said nothing more, but Headrock had his picture of a council of very human members, jealous of their prerogatives. These people would not easily accept his decision, when he finally made it, on the problem of the seesaw drama that was being played to its still undetermined conclusion in ever remoter bends of time. He saw that his audience was becoming restless. Eyes turned involuntarily toward the time map, and several men glanced anxiously at their watches. Hastily, Headrock withdrew from the room with its almost invisible energy floors. Watching that pendulum could become a drug. The brain itself would be weakened by the strain of attending a mechanism which recorded the spasms of real bodies and their movements through time itself. It was bad enough to know that the building and the man were swinging steadily back and forth. He arrived back in his office just in time to catch a stat call up from Lucy. "In spite of my efforts," she said, "I was forced out of the Penny Palace. And when the door shut, I knew what was going to happen. I'm afraid he was taken to one of the houses of illusion, and you know what that means." Headrock nodded thoughtfully. He noted sharply that the girl seemed disturbed by her experience. "Among other things," he said slowly, "the illusion energies have some qualifying effect on callidity. The nature of the modification cannot be determined without subsequent measurement, but it can be stated with reasonable certainty that his luck will never again take the direction of success at gambling." He had delayed his reaction while he examined her face. Now he said with decision, "It is unfortunate that Clark has fallen prey to all these pitfalls of the city so easily. But since he was never more than a long-run possibility, we can let him go without regret, particularly, and this cannot be stressed too often, as even the slightest interference in the natural progression of his life would cause later suspicion that would nullify any good he might do us. You may accordingly consider yourself detached from him. Further instructions will be given you in due course." He paused. "What's the matter, Lucy? Got an emotional fixation on him?" Her expression left no doubt of it. Headrock pressed on quietly. "When did you discover it?" Whatever resistance had been in her, whatever fear of discovery, was gone.
"It was when those other women were kissing him. You mustn't think," she added hastily, "that disturbed me. He'll go through quite a lot of it before he settles down."
"Not necessarily," said Headrock earnestly. "You'll have to resign yourself to the House of Illusion, but it has been my observation that a fair percentage of men emerge from such an experience, hard as steel in some respects, but rather weary of worldliness." He realized from her face that he had said enough. The groundwork for her future action was established. Results would follow in the natural course of events. He smiled a friendly smile. "That's all for now, Lucy. Don't let it get you down." Her image and his faded from the screen in a flash. Robert Headrock glanced out of the door of his office several times during the next hour. At first, the corridor seemed very busy. Gradually, the activity died down, and at last the corridor was clear. He acted now with decision, but without haste. From a wall safe, he took the microfilm plans of the time control machine, the one in the room where he had talked to the weapon shop counselors a little more than 2 hours before. He had requested Information Center to send them to him, and they had done so without comment. There was nothing unusual in their compliance. As head of the coordination department, he had access to all the scientific knowledge of the weapon shops. He even had an explanation as to why he wanted the plans in the event that he was asked. He wanted to study them, so his story would go, in the hope that some solution would suggest itself. But his reasons were private, and his purpose personal. With the films in his pocket, he headed along the corridor toward the nearest stairway. He went down 5 flights and came to a section of the Hotel Royal Ganil that was not occupied by the weapon shops. He unlocked an apartment door, went inside, and locked the door behind him. It was an imposing suite, as befitted an executive of the weapon shops, 5 rooms and a tremendous library. He went straight to the library, closed and locked the door, then carefully examined the place for spying devices. There were none, which was what he expected. As far as he knew, he was not under suspicion. But he never took unnecessary chances. Swiftly, he held one of the rings on his finger against an ordinary-looking electric socket. A loop of metal slid out. He inserted his finger into the loop and pulled. What happened in that moment was an ordinary enough weapon shop phenomenon. He was transmitted by a weapon shop matter transmitter a distance of about 1,100 miles into one of his numerous laboratories. What was out of the ordinary about the action was that the presence of the transmitter was not known to the weapon shop council. The laboratory had for centuries been one of his many closely guarded secret retreats. He decided that he could safely remain an hour, but that all he could hope to do in one night was to make another print of the microfilm. Building a duplicate machine would require many visits such as this. As it turned out, he had time to make an extra print of the plans. Very carefully, he put the additional copy into a vault filing case, there to join the tens of thousands of other diagrams and plans to which, over a period of several thousand years, he had given an AA priority. At the end of the hour, Earth's one immortal man, founder of the weapon shops, possessor of secrets unknown to any other living human being, returned to the library of his apartment in the Hotel Royal Ganil. Presently, he was back in his office, 5 flights farther up.